Hello, this is Steve Bailey, bringing you another episode of Hard-Boiled Eggs and Nuts, a Laurel and Hardy podcast. And I try not to keep these, episodes not topical, because there's no sense in saying Happy Sunday when you're listening to this on a Tuesday. However, I want to note that I am recording this particular segment on Memorial Day weekend in 2018. So if you happen to be listening to this on the last week of May 2018, have a safe and happy Memorial Day weekend. And I thought that I would do something appropriate for that particular weekend. I have tried to avoid the 20th Century Fox features because I really wanted to keep those until the very end of my podcast series. But some themes just lend themselves to them. I did a previous episode where I covered the Dancing Masters, and so for Memorial Day, I thought I would cover their very first feature for 20th Century Fox from 1941, Great Guns. Now, I have very, very mixed feelings about this movie. If you know anything about the history of Laurel and Hardy, you know that this was their introduction to the big studio system. Previously, from 1927 to 1940, for the most part, they had worked at Hal Roach Studios, where Stan, as the creative person, the uncredited writer, director, and editor of the Laurel and Hardy comedies, pretty much had free latitude. He'd have some run-ins with Hal Roach over stories and different things. But for the most part, he was able to make the Laurel and Hardy movies the way he wanted to without interference from the front office. And when Laurel and Hardy did get tired of some of the contractual problems that they had with Hal Roach, they finally broke from him and established Laurel and Hardy Feature Productions, under which they eventually signed a contract with 20th Century Fox. And this was a one-picture contract at the beginning, based on whether this movie would be a success or not. They would get to do successive pictures for Fox. And apparently, Laurel, again, as the creative person, naively assumed that he would have the same sort of creative control as he had at the Hal Roach Studios. And this was far from the case. For one thing, they made their movies completely in sequence when they made them at Roach Studios. So that if something came up in one scene that contributed to maybe a gag in a later scene, they could use it and it would still all fit together. So they go to 20th Century Fox and find that everything is completely opposite of the way they did it. They have a script already prepared. They had no input into it. And their movies at Fox and later at MGM were filmed out of sequence, as most studio movies are. And so that meant that Stan couldn't lend himself to creating future gags. Everything was already set up. And, of course, the one worst part that everybody points out is that their makeup for Fox, the makeup they used on their face and so forth, actually made them look older than they were. Whereas they had white sort of clown face in the Roach movies, here they were made up to look more supposedly natural, and yet really emphasized their wrinkles and made them look older. So there are all these things that obviously weigh against the movie. And if you see the movie, it's not typical Laurel and Hardy. You know that it's a little bit, it's really jazzed up. The pace is, it's only 74 minutes long and it moves like lightning, as one of the biographers of Laurel and Hardy has pointed out. But it's not quite them. You get the feeling that they're being asked to imitate somebody else, and that if somebody else was Abbott and Costello, whose second feature film, Buck Privates came out in February of 1941 and was a huge box office smash. So obviously somebody at Fox decided to ape the format, and 8 months later, Great Guns came out. So there are all these things weighing against it, and up until, say, 20 or so years ago, history was not kind to the movie or to any of their 20th Century Fox features. And yet the strange thing is, when you watch it with an open mind, it is actually a fairly funny movie. It's not a masterpiece. It's not their greatest movie. But there's enough in it that's familiarly Laurel and Hardy that I think you can enjoy it. There are a few bumps in the road, and I will certainly discuss those. But the nice thing is, most reports say that once Stan knew what he was up against, he was very quiet. You know, usually he was very vivacious and outgoing and wanting to contribute to the movie. And apparently, when he found out what the situation was at Fox, he sort of shut down and just became very quiet. And yet, the funny thing is, if you watch this movie, Laurel and Hardy, you're not phoning it in. Stan and Ollie, you're not, you know, they're still recognizable characters as we know them. There's a lot of uncharacteristic stuff, which again, I will discuss. But they still provide the same grace notes, the physical comedy and the body language. And I don't know how much of that was actually scripted in the script, which was written by Lou Breslow before they started filming, and how much of it they improvised on the set, because apparently they were allowed to improvise very little to none. And yet there's so many familiar elements that come through that it's a fairly enjoyable movie. So let me get on with the movie in question. It begins with Stan manicuring a lawn along with his pet crow Penelope. And it turns out that Stan and Ollie work for a very rich young man named Dick Forrester. And Stan is the yard man, I guess, because he's sitting there very meticulously manicuring a lawn with a pair of teeny scissors. And Ollie is the chauffeur working on the car. So a mailman comes up and delivers, I'm always making these little mistakes all the way through, even though I try to be as correct as possible, so forgive me. Anyway, Dan Forrester is the rich young man, and he gets his draft notice in the mail, and Ollie informs us via exposition that there's no way that he could possibly be accepted into the Army. Dan is allergic to 108 different elements, according to his family doctor, Dr. Schickle, who is there to sit there and cluck over him and insist that he is physically malnourished. But Dan gets his draft notice and he's raring to go. And so he has to go to the report to the draft board, of course. And Stan and Ollie go with him and manage to sneak into the room with him while he's getting his physical. And Stan and Ollie hide behind a curtain, and every time the doctor insists that something about Dan is fine, he's perfectly healthy, he's okay, one or the other of them pops up either from behind the curtain or over it to give their editorial commentary about it. That's more of an Abbott and Costello type of routine, but Laurel and Hardy pull it off very well. It's very fast-paced and funny, and it's funny how they do pop out of nowhere to make their little comments. So anyway, Dan is declared perfectly healthy. And so on that basis, Stan and Ollie enlist in order to take care of Daniel. And that's a curious element, because Stan and Ollie are already obviously long in the tooth. It would have been interesting to see the physical that they got. But in any case, we then see the train dropping off draftees at the Army division. And it turns out to be a cavalry division, which is probably the most curious thing about this whole thing. The train comes out, the draftees come out, and most of them are not young men at all. You would expect, you know, young, clean, crew-cut men to be popping out. And it's mostly guys who are maybe 10 years younger than Stan and Ollie. And they're all dressed in coats and ties like businessmen. And they can't wait to join the Army and be macho and play on horses. Now, I know that they did, obviously, draft older men. My own father was 30 or 31 years old when he was drafted to participate in World War II. But still, these guys look pretty long in the tooth to be, you know, naive soldiers. In any case, they all come out, and it turns out Penelope the Crow has hitchhiked, and she pops up occasionally in the bunch. And next, they are told to go to the mess hall and get their food, get a meal as soon as possible. Unfortunately, this particular scene starts the trend of Ollie Fat jokes, because Lou Breslow obviously has a plus-size man co-starring in these movies and just can't wait to get off the fat jokes. And at one point, a soldier, they're in line and trying to butt, because they don't do it nastily or deliberately. They just didn't know where they were supposed to go in line. And one of the draftees nudges Ollie and says, "Get out of the way, blimp." And there's more fun like that to come, which I'll mention in a minute. And so they don't realize that for some reason that they have to get in line. They figure, I guess, that they have to serve Daniel. And so Stan goes all the way around. It's a beautifully timed and filmed scene. Stan is just oblivious in the usual Stanley way. He's not trying to disobey orders or anything, but he thinks, basically, you see that his thinking is, man, I don't want to have to wait in line for all this. I need to go ahead and collect the meal. So he bumps in front of everybody, goes straight ahead, goes behind the tables where the cooks and chefs and so forth are working, and gets two full trays collected before anybody realizes that the soldier has butted in line. So they put their meals down on the table and see Daniel across the way. And they go to talk to him and saying, you shouldn't be eating this full meal. It'll do you to harm and all this kind of stuff. And finally, Daniel says, you guys better worry about your own meal. And they go back to their table, and two of the burly draftees are already eating their food. And Ollie says, basically, why are you stealing our food? You know that an army has to, an army works on its stomach. And one of the guys says, what are you beefing about? You got enough here, pointing to Ollie's stomach. You got enough there to make China and back. So, great. Another fat joke. Just what we were looking for. Anyway, at one point, they're in line, an inspection line. And Stan and Ollie are still both in their naive way. They have a sergeant named Hippo. I assume that's the nickname. Nobody ever says otherwise. But anyway, very large and intimidating guy. And of course, he's frustrated that he has these two guys who don't have a clue what's going on in his infantry. So at one point, all the soldiers, including Stan and Ollie, are lined up for inspection. And Sergeant Hippo's colonel comes along, and Ollie happens to have an old-fashioned camera, one of those big box cameras that he has brought with him, and nonchalantly asks the colonel if he will take their picture. And Sergeant says, no, no. And the colonel backs him off. He says, it's okay, let me do this. And he goes along with the entire routine, taking their picture and making small talk with them until the sergeant finally yells, this is the colonel, knock it off, basically. So it's kind of funny that the colonel was willing to go along with this and not even admit that he was a colonel. So from there, some fairly decent comedy. From that point, we get the subplot. Daniel goes to the camp photo shop to get Ollie's photos developed, and he meets the cashier and the camera worker named Ginger. And Sergeant Hippo is already there trying to make time with Ginger, and she is not at all interested. And yet when Daniel comes up, she's willing to let him come back to the darkroom to help her develop the photos. Needless to say, this does not sit well with Sergeant Hippo. This makes them rivals for Ginger's affections, as if we cared. But the worst part is the insults that Daniel allows for Stan and Ollie. They develop the photos, and Ginger looks at them and says, has Ripley ever seen them? As in Ripley's Believe It or Not. Like, in other words, who would believe these guys as soldiers? And far from trying to defend them, Daniel goes right along with it. They end up comparing Ollie and Stan to, respectively, an observation balloon and a hydrant. So, yeah, of course, that makes us real sympathetic to Dan Forrester. So then the next scene is in a rodeo on the cavalry grounds, where the soldiers are supposed to participate in riding bucking broncos to see how long they will last. Daniel comes up, and Stan and Ollie, of course, discourage him because this is going to be terrible for his health. And instead, he goes and rides the Bronco terrifically, manages to stay on his back the whole time. Sergeant Hippo is jealous, of course, so he jumps on another Bronco and tries to ride and gets kicked off in a matter of seconds. And Stan and Ollie and everyone else laugh derisively at him. This is another weakness in the movie. You would think that they would be trying to get laughs out of Stan and Ollie doing something like that rather than them sitting on the sidelines. So then, as punishment for having laughed at them, Sergeant Hippo has Stan and Ollie walk 2 horses 5 miles uphill. Eventually, the horses run away, and the boys decide to get back to camp. They stow away on what they think is a moving flat car with a big canvas on it. It turns out the canvas is actually a moving target to be used for target practice. And before they realize what happens, or what is happening, Ollie gets his uniform's buttons shot off, and the boys skedaddle off the flat car as soon as they can. So once they get back to camp, Sergeant Hippo comes in and gives them grief, and then it's been shown that they kept a shell as a souvenir from this little adventure, and Dan sees and realizes what it is. He says, "You better get rid of that gunpowder." So they open it up and they dump the gunpowder in this canister. Well, when Sergeant Hippo comes in, he starts bossing them around. "This tent looks terrible. Get it cleaned up." And while they're cleaning up the tent, Hippo decides to fill up his pipe with what he thinks is tobacco, but of course it's the gunpowder. And Stan and Ollie continuously plead for him to not do that because they know what's in there and he won't listen to it. So finally he fills up the pipe, goes outside off screen, and we hear this huge explosion, and he comes back and he's covered with gunpowder. And Stan and Ollie are laughing their heads off when he leaves, and Stan calls him Old Black Joe, another reference to blackface. So, golly, there's just so much that's out of character. I mean, I know that I said most of it's in character, but when they include, you know, cheap blackface references and things like that, that's when you realize that they don't quite have the idea of what Laurel and Hardy are all about. So, during another inspection lineup, Penelope the Crow returns and sits on Stan's head, on the cap on his head. And Ollie orders Stan to hide the bird somewhere, and he does. He hides the bird in Ollie's trousers. And this results in a wonderful bit of comedy. It's kind of mechanical, and at the same time, it's done beautifully. Because here's this general coming along again, and Ollie is, of course, supposed to be standing at attention, but the crow keeps pecking at his behind, and he goes absolutely crazy. And very funny physical comedy from Oliver Hardy. It's probably, like I said, a mechanical sort of routine, but he does it so well you can't help but laugh at it. The general, by the way, is played by an actor named Paul Harvey, not the radio announcer, but an actual actor named Paul Harvey from the 40s. And if that name sounds familiar, he is also the man who harasses Groucho Marx at the hotel lobby in the Marx Brothers movie, A Night in Casablanca. Completely unrecognizable from that movie in this one. Then we go back to the photo shop where we again get the tired rivalry for Ginger's affections. The most interesting part of this return to the photo shop is that there's a soldier making conversation with Ginger, and that soldier is played by none other than Alan Ladd, who I believe this was his third movie, and he hadn't quite achieved stardom yet. And then a couple of years later did This Gun for Hire and was immediately a big star. So, next thing we see is Laurel and Hardy preparing to go to bed. And again, I don't know if this was in the script. I tend to think Stan either improvised it or managed to insert it himself. But he does a wonderful bit of white magic. If you're not familiar with the concept of white magic, Stan manages to pull off these outrageous tricks every so often that nobody can figure out how he does. For example, in Way Out West, he wants to smoke a pipe, but he doesn't have a pipe. So he stuffs tobacco into his hands, lights it, and sucks his thumb like a pipe. And it actually works. For Stan only, of course. Well, in this movie, it's in the dead of night. As I say, they're getting ready to go to bed. Stan wants to shave, but he can't see what he's doing in the mirror. So he goes to a light bulb that's hooked up, And you see the light emanating from it. And he unscrews it, thinking, well, I'll go put it over by the mirror and then I'll be able to see. Well, the funny thing is, the light bulb stays lit the entire time he holds it. And when he actually screws it into the socket, that's when it doesn't work. And Stan can't figure this out. And Ollie is looking on in dismay, as he usually does. Finally, Stan's solution is to stick the lit light bulb into his mouth and leave it lit so that he can see what he's doing while he's shaving. Pretty funny. The boys hear Daniel talking in their sleep and realize he's in love with a girl named Ginger. And that they figure they have to break it up for, again, the sake of his physical health. So this results in another debit from one of these Fox films. It puts Stan and Ollie in costume and turns them into these outrageous second characters. Well, Ollie has gotten the idea that they should dress up as rich tycoons and insist to Ginger that she's probably heard by now, or he has told her that he is a very rich man. And so they decide that they're going to portray these other two men. They have fancy costumes on. Ollie plays Mr. Murgatroyd, and Stan plays Sylvester Sneer. And the idea is they go to Ginger's apartment to talk to her and tell her Daniel isn't rich at all. We've been having to finance everything that he does because he's near bankruptcy. And it would be a very terrible idea for you to get involved with him because he has no money at all. Well, they start this routine, and she finds it suspicious at first anyway. And then she happens to look at a picture that's adorning her table. And it's one of the pictures of Dan with Stan and Ollie. And, of course, she instantly realizes who it is. As corny as this scene is, it's actually done pretty well. Instead of Hardy doing the dialogue straight on, he puts a bit of a flourish on it, overacting. And as pointed out in one of the Laurel and Hardy biographies, his hamminess actually saves the scene, as does that of Sheila Ryan, the woman who plays Ginger. She starts to go along with it and also hams it up. Oh my gosh, what am I to do with my future? That kind of thing. And they end up turning a so-so scene into actually a pretty good one, in spite of itself. So, they realize that their plan didn't work. They go back to camp, and they're talking to Daniel, and Sergeant Hippo comes in and starts his usual routine of hassling people, and he especially gets after Daniel, of course, because he doesn't like Daniel. So, as Sergeant Hippo turns around and gets ready to leave the tent, Ollie throws a wet towel at him, and when Sergeant Hippo turns around, they make it look as though Daniel was the one who threw it. And Sergeant Hippo accuses Daniel of insubordination and gets him trotted off to the guardhouse. This, too, is a bit extreme for Stan and Ollie. You wouldn't think they'd be that aggressive about it, and they end up feeling guilty about it. That's the one nice capper to the scene, is that they get a crying scene out of it because they realize what a nasty thing they had to do, and they fall all over each other crying, which is kind of a nice capper to the scene. So finally, the last 15 minutes involve war games. The colonel explains that there's going to be a white team and a blue team, and the object of the whole game, the whole war game, is to keep the blue team from building this bridge, because if they manage to build a bridge, they can get on to the other side to reach the white team and conquer them. This is going to sound very strange, but upon reflection, I just watched this movie again for the, I don't know, third or fourth time in my life. And it's funny how, and please forgive me for this indulgence, but it actually reminds me of the climax of Star Wars. I don't mean that the special effects are that as fabulous as in that movie, but it's funny how it follows the same sort of plot line. You get this high-up officer who gives us a whole ream of exposition so that we can understand the good guys versus the bad guys, and how one of them needs to triumph in order for the movie to have a happy ending. So it's just a side note. I'm sure George Lucas didn't watch Great Guns and say, oh gosh, this will make a great ending for my movie. But it is funny how the two kind of have the same sort of plot line. So whenever you watch Great Guns, just give that a thought in the back of your mind. In any case, the boys are on the white team, and there's a huge kind of drawn out scene where they're trying to reach their troop and Stan is crazily driving a Jeep all over the place. It's intercut between shots of probably what is obviously a stunt double and fast motion photography, intercut with some nice shots of Stan and Ollie with some process photography, making it look as though the Jeep is bouncing up and down. So it's acceptable. The one thing that isn't acceptable is when the blue team, airplane pilots from the blue team are up in the sky and they drop bombs. Now, these are not real bombs, of course. What they are is huge sacks of flour. Nevertheless, the idea is to drop them on the white team soldiers and try to knock them out and keep them from accomplishing their goal. So Stan is driving along, and one of these huge bags of flour hits Ollie and spreads flour all over him. And Stan looks back at him, and as Randy Skredved pointed out in his Laurel and Hardy book, in the old days, if something like that had happened, Stan would be trying to help Ollie clean up and probably making him messier in the process. Instead, Stan looks back at Ollie and says, "You look like a biscuit," and he laughs derisively until he is hit by one of these bags of flour as well. Well, eventually, Stan and Ollie's Jeep lands in a river that is near the Blue Army, and they are captured by the Blue Army, so they are forced to work on the Blue Army's bridge. The best part of this scene is a gag that is replayed from their silent film, The Finishing Touch, where Ollie is working on the bridge, and Stan passes by with a beam. He's holding one end of it, and the beam goes along and along and along and along. Finally, we see the other end of the beam, and Stan is holding that end as well, which, of course, leaves Ollie in disbelief. And it's a running gag that goes on for another couple of shots that are intercut later, and it's actually pretty funny. So, the big news is in the climax. Daniel manages to escape from the guardhouse and gets the bright idea, and it is actually pretty bright. Penelope, at this point, the crow, has been kept in a cage, in a private little cage, so that nobody can see her. And Stan feeds her and then covers up the cage and sends it on up to the ceiling. Well, Daniel knows all about this. So he rushes back to the tent, gets Penelope, and, of course, the whole raison d'etre of this thing is for them to find out where the Blue Army is. So again, Daniel gets the bright idea. Well, Penelope will know where they are because she always follows Stan. So he lets Penelope loose, lets the White Army know what's going on. And of course, they're incredulous about it at first. And finally, the commanding officer says, "Well, we don't have any better idea. Let's follow this crow and see what happens." So of course, they follow the crow. They find Stan and Ollie, and they find the Blue Army. And so, of course, they managed to blow up the Blue Army's bridge, and they win the war game. Too bad that they didn't have Stan and Ollie themselves trying to do something to actually bring this forth, but, you know, Penelope is a good second. So the final scene, we see a huge victory parade, and we see Daniel participating in it, as well as Stan and Ollie. Stan and Ollie get their own separate shot. It looks as though they're sitting on a tank, saluting and acting very officious. And then the camera pulls back and shows that the tank belongs to a sanitary unit, which, of course, implies that Stan and Ollie are now in charge of cleaning up dung at the camp. Ha ha. And so that's the end of the movie. Again, if you are willing to make allowances for it, it's fairly decent movie. I can't say it's a credit to Stan. I can understand why he was very upset at not being able to do it his own way. But it looks as though Fox at least made an effort to try to feed to their characters, even though they weren't entirely successful. But, excuse me, in any case, I would say, although it is sort of average, it's definitely not as painful to watch as earlier Laurel and Hardy history would have led you to believe. So seek it out. I'm sure if you look very hard, you can find it somewhere on the internet. Thank you for indulging me. Let me go ahead and include my usual plugs. I have a Facebook page devoted to this podcast, and it's the same name as the podcast, Hard Boiled Eggs and Nuts, a Laurel and Hardy podcast. So please look for it on Facebook. If you go to that Facebook page, you will see that on the cover photo, there is a listing of first the URL of the podcast's website, and then also URLs of the various venues where this podcast is available, including Google Play Music, Stitcher, Overcast, and especially Anchor, the parent website that sponsors this podcast. Secondly, I have a website that I have devoted to Laurel and Hardy for the past 18 years. It includes my reviews of their movies, reviews of Laurel and Hardy biographies, interviews with their biographers, and tons of other Stan and Ollie-related stuff you're sure to enjoy for hours to come. The URL for this website is leaveemlaughing.moviefever.com. That is leaveemlaughing.moviefever.com. And lastly, I welcome feedback of any kind. If you have anything to say about this webcast, positive or negative, I welcome the feedback. Please email me at hardboiledeggsandnuts@outlook.com. And if this is your first time listening to the podcast, I hope you will indulge in some of the 20-odd episodes that preceded it and listen to me blather on about my love for Laurel and Hardy. I thank you very much for listening. And until next time, again, happy Memorial Day weekend. And this is Steve Bailey saying goodbye.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.